"Inconvenience?" snorted Roonan. "I have no more coordination than a fledgling. I'm a stranger in a stranger's house."
Still grumbling, she subsided into mental deliberations that were incomprehensible to Aragorn, then said,
"Well, I may have a solution. But I warn you, I shall not continue if I am unable to maintain my usual level of craftsmanship."
She did not explain the solution to either Aragorn or Saphira, but one by one placed the plates of steel on the anvil and cracked them into flakes no wider than rose petals. Gathering up half the flakes of the harder bright steel, Roonan stacked them into a brick, which she then coated with clay and birch bark to hold them together. The brick went on a thick steel paddle with a 7-foot-long handle, similar to those used by bakers to insert and remove loaves of bread from a hot oven. Roonan laid the end of the paddle in the center of the forge, and then backed Aragorn as far away as she could and still have him hold on to the handle. Then she asked Saphira to resume breathing fire, and again the atrium glowed with a flickering blue radiance. The heat was so intense Aragorn felt as if his exposed skin were crisping, and he saw that the granite stones of which the forge was made had acquired a bright yellow glow. The bright steel could easily have taken over half an hour to reach the appropriate temperature in a charcoal fire, but it required only a few minutes in the withering inferno of Saphira's flames before it turned white. The moment it did, Roonan ordered Saphira to cease breathing fire. Darkness engulfed the forge as Saphira closed her jaws. Rushing Aragorn forward, Roonan had him transport the glowing brick of clay-covered steel to the anvil, where she seized a hammer and welded the disparate flakes of bright steel into a cohesive whole. She continued to pound on the metal, elongating it out into a bar, then made a cut in the middle, folded the metal back on itself, and welded the two pieces together. The bell-like peals of ringing metal echoed off the ancient trees that surrounded the atrium. Roonan had Aragorn return the bright steel to the forge once its color had faded from white to yellow, and again Saphira bathed the metal with the fire from her belly. 6 times Roonan heated and folded the bright steel, and each time the metal became smoother and more flexible, until it could bend without tearing. As Aragorn hammered the steel, his every action dictated by Roonan, the elf woman began to sing, both with his tongue and her own. Together their voices formed a not unpleasant harmony that rose and fell with the beats of the hammer. A tingle crawled down Aragorn's spine as he felt Roonan channel a steady flow of energy into the words they were mouthing, and he realized that the song contained spells of making, shaping, and binding. With their voices, too, Roonan sang of the metal that lay on the anvil, describing its properties, altering them in ways that exceeded Aragorn's understanding, and imbuing the bright steel with a complex web of enchantments designed to give it strength and resilience beyond that of any ordinary metal. Of Aragorn's hammer arm, Roonan also sang, and under the gentle influence of her crooning, every blow she struck with his arm landed upon its intended target. Roonan quenched the bar of bright steel after the 6th and final fold was complete. She repeated the entire process with the other half of the hard bright steel, forging an identical bar to the first. Then she gathered up the fragments of the softer steel, which she folded and welded 10 times before forming it into a short, heavy wedge. Next, Roonan had Saphira reheat the 2 bars of harder steel. Roonan laid the shining rods side by side on her anvil, grasped both of them at either end with a pair of tongs, and then twisted the rods around each other 7 times. Sparks shot into the air as she hammered upon the twists to weld them into a single piece of metal. The resulting mass of bright steel, Roonan folded, welded, and pounded back out to length another 6 times. When she was pleased with the quality of the metal, Roonan flattened the bright steel into a thick rectangular sheet, cut the sheet in half lengthwise with a sharp chisel, and bent each of the 2 halves down their middle, so they were in the shape of long, shallow V's. And all that, Aragorn estimated, Roonan was able to accomplish within the course of 1.5 hours. He marvelled at her speed, even though it was his own body that carried out the tasks. Never before had he seen a smith shape metal with such ease. What would have taken Horst hours took her only minutes. And yet, no matter how demanding the forging was, Runan continued to sing, weaving a fabric of spells within the bright steel and guiding Aragorn's arm with infallible accuracy. Amid the frenzy of noise, fire, sparks and exertion, Aragorn thought he glimpsed, as Runan raked his eyes across the forge, a trio of slender figures standing by the edge of the atrium. Saphira confirmed his suspicion a moment later when she said,
"Aragorn, we are not alone."
"Who are they?" he asked. Saphira sent him an image of the short, wizened weircat Maud, in human form, standing between two pale elves who were no taller than she. One of the elves was male, the other female, and they were both extraordinarily beautiful, even by the standards of the elves. Their solemn teardrop faces seemed wise and innocent in equal measure, which made it impossible for Aragorn to judge their age. Their skin displayed a faint, silvery sheen, as if the two elves were so filled with energy it was seeping out of their very flesh. Aragorn queried Runan as to the identity of the elves, when she paused to allow his body a brief rest. Runan glanced at them, affording him a slightly better view. Then, without interrupting her song, she said with her thoughts,
"They are Elana and Dusan, the only elf children in Ellesmere. There was much rejoicing when they were conceived 12 years ago."
"They are like no other elves I've met," he said.
"Our children are special, Shadeslayer. They are blessed with certain gifts, gifts of grace and gifts of power, which no grown elf can hope to match. As we age, our blossom withers somewhat, although the magic of our early years never completely abandons us."
Runan wasted no more time talking. She had Aragorn place the wedge of bright steel between the two V-shaped strips and hammer on them until the strips nearly enveloped the wedge, and friction held the three pieces together. Then Runan welded the pieces into a hole, and while the metal was still hot, she began to draw it out and form a rough blank of the sword. The soft wedge became the spine of the blade, while the two harder strips became the sides, edges, and point. Once the blank was nearly as long as the finished sword, the work slowed, as Runan returned to the tang and carefully hammered her way up the blade, establishing the final angles and proportions. Runan had Saphira heat the blade in segments of no more than 6 or 7 inches at a time, which Runan arranged by holding the blade over one of Saphira's nostrils, through which Saphira would release a single jet of fire. A host of writhing shadows fled toward the perimeter of the atrium every time the fire sprang into existence. Aragorn watched with amazement as his hands transformed the crude lump of metal into an elegant instrument of war. With every blow, the outline of the blade became clearer, as if the bright steel wanted to be a sword and was eager to assume the shape Runan desired. At last, the forging came to a close, and there on the anvil lay a long, black blade, which, although it was still rough and incomplete, already radiated a sense of deadly purpose. Runan allowed Aragorn's tired arms to rest while the blade cooled by air. Then she had Aragorn take the blade to another corner of her workshop, where she had arranged 6 different grinding wheels, and on a small bench a wide assortment of files, scrapers, and abrasive stones. She fixed the blade between 2 blocks of wood, and spent the next hour planing the sides of the sword with a draw knife, as well as refining the contours of the blade with files. As with the hammering, every stroke of the draw knife and every scrape of a file seemed to have twice the effect it normally would. It was as if the tools knew exactly how much steel to remove, and would remove no more. When she was done filing, Runan built a charcoal fire in her forge, and while she waited for the fire to mature, she mixed a slurry of dark, fine-grained clay, ash, powdered pumice, and crystallized juniper sap. She painted the blade with the concoction, slathering twice as much on the spine as she did along the edges and by the point. The thicker the solution of clay, the slower the underlying metal would cool when it was quenched, and as a result, the softer that area of the sword would become. The clay lightened as Runan dried it with a quick incantation. At the direction of the elf woman, Aragorn went to the forge. He lay the sword flat upon the bed of scintillating coals, and pumping the bellows with his free hand, slowly pulled it toward his hip. Once the tip of the blade came free of the fire, Runan turned it over and repeated the sequence. She continued to draw the blade through the coals until both edges had acquired an even orange tone, and the spine of the sword was bright red in color. Then with a single smooth motion, Runan lifted the sword from the coals, swept the glowing bar of steel through the air, and plunged it into the trough of water next to the forge. An explosive cloud of steam erupted from the surface of the water, which hissed and sizzled and bubbled around the blade. After a minute, the roiling water subsided, and Runan withdrew the now pearl-grey sword. Returning it to the fire, she brought the whole sword to the same low heat, so as to reduce the brittleness of the edges, and then quenched it once more. Aragorn had expected Runan to relinquish her hold on his body after they had forged, hardened, and tempered the blade, but to his surprise, she remained in his mind, and continued to control his limbs. Runan had him douse the forge. Then she walked Aragorn back to the bench with the files and scrapers and abrasive stones. There she sat him, and making use of ever finer stones, she polished the blade. From her memories, Aragorn learned that she would normally spend a week or more polishing a blade, but because of the song they sang, she, through him, was able to complete the task in a mere 4 hours. In addition to carving a narrow groove down the middle of each side of the blade. As the bright steel grew smoother, the true beauty of the metal was revealed. Within it, Aragorn could see a shimmering cable-like pattern, every line of which marked the transition between 2 layers of the velvety steel. And along each edge of the sword was a rippling, silvery-white band as wide as his thumb, which made it appear as if the edges burned with tongues of frozen fire. The muscles in Aragorn's right arm gave way, as Runan was covering the tang with decorative cross-hatching, and the file he was holding slipped off the tang and fell from his fingers. The extent of his exhaustion surprised him, for he had been concentrating upon the sword to the exclusion of all else.
"Enough," said Runan,
and she removed herself from Aragorn's mind without further ado. Shocked by her sudden absence, Aragorn swayed on his seat and nearly lost his balance before he regained control over his rebellious limbs.
"But we're not finished,"
he protested, turning toward Runan. The night sounded unnaturally quiet to him, without the strains of their extended duet. Runan rose from where she had been sitting cross-legged against the pole, and shook her head.
"I have no more need of you, Shadeslayer. Go and dream until dawn."
"But—"
"You are tired, and even with my magic you are liable to ruin the sword if you continue to work on it. Now that the blade is done, I can attend to the rest without interference from my oath. So go. You will find a bed on the 2nd floor of my house. If you are hungry, there is food in the pantry."
Aragorn hesitated, reluctant to leave, then nodded, and shambled away from the bench, his feet dragging in the dirt. As he passed her, he ran a hand over Saphira's wing and bid her good night, too weary to say more. In return, she tousled his hair with a warm puff of air and said,
"I shall watch and remember for you, little one."
Aragorn paused on the threshold of Runan's house and looked across the shadowy atrium to where Maud and the 2 elf children were still standing. He raised a hand in greeting, and Maud smiled at him, baring her sharp, pointed teeth. A tingle crawled down Aragorn's neck as the elf children gazed at him. Their large, slanted eyes were slightly luminous in the gloom. When they made no other motion, he ducked his head and hurried inside, eager to lie down upon a soft mattress. A Rider in Full.
"Wake, little one," said Saphira. "The sun has risen, and Runan is impatient.
Aragorn bolted upright, throwing off his blankets as easily as he cast off his waking dreams. His arms and shoulders were sore from his exertions of the previous day. He pulled on his boots, fumbling with the laces in his excitement, grabbed his grimy apron from the floor, and bounded down the elaborately carved stairs to the entryway of Runan's curved house. Outside, the sky was bright with the first light of dawn, although shadow still enveloped the atrium. Aragorn spotted Runan and Saphira by the open-walled forge and trotted over to them, combing his hair into place with his fingers. Runan stood, leaning against the edge of the bench. There were dark bags under her eyes, and the lines on her face were heavier than before. The sword lay before her, concealed beneath a length of white cloth.
"I have done the impossible," she said, the words hoarse and broken. "I made a sword when I swore I would not. What is more, I made it in less than a day, and with hands that were not my own. Yet the sword is not crude or shoddy. No, it is the finest sword I have ever forged. I would have preferred to use less magic during the process, but that is my only qualm, and it is a small one compared with the perfection of the results. Behold!"
Grasping the corner of the cloth, Runan pulled it aside, revealing the sword. Aragorn gasped. He had thought that in the handful of hours since he had left her, Runan would only have had enough time to fabricate a plain hilt and crossguard for the sword, and maybe a simple wooden scabbard. Instead, the sword Aragorn saw on the bench was as magnificent as Zarok, Naegling, and Tamerlane, and, in his opinion, more beautiful than any of them. Covering the blade was a glossy scabbard of the same dark blue as the scales on Saphira's back. The colour displayed a slight variegation, like the mottled light at the bottom of a clear forest pond. A piece of blued bright steel carved in the shape of a leaf capped the end of the scabbard, while a collar decorated with stylized vines encircled the mouth. The curved crossguard was also made of blued bright steel, as were the four ribs that held in place the large sapphire that formed the pommel. The hand and a half hilt was made of hard black wood. Overcome by a sense of reverence, Aragorn reached out toward the sword, then paused and glanced at Runan. "May I?" he asked. She inclined her head.
"You may. I give it to thee, Shadeslayer."
Aragorn lifted the sword from the bench. The scabbard and the wood of the hilt were cool to the touch. For several minutes he marvelled at the details on the scabbard and the guard and the pommel. Then he tightened his grip around the hilt and unsheathed the blade. Like the rest of the sword, the blade was blue, but of a slightly lighter shade. It was the blue of the scales in the hollow of Saphira's throat, rather than the blue of those on her back. And as it was on Zarok, the colour was iridescent. As Aragorn moved the sword about, the colour would shimmer and shift, displaying any of the many tones of blue present on Saphira herself. Through the wash of colour, the cable-like patterns within the bright steel and the pale bands along the edges were still visible. With a single hand, Aragorn swung the sword through the air, and he laughed at how light and fast it felt. The sword almost seemed alive. He grasped the sword with both his hands then, and was delighted to find they fit perfectly on the longer hilt. Lunging forward, he stabbed at an imaginary enemy, and was confident they would have died from the attack. "Here," said Runan, and pointed at a bundle of three iron rods planted upright in the ground outside the forge.
"Try it on those."
Aragorn allowed himself a moment to focus his thoughts, then took a single step toward the rods. With a yell, he slashed downward and cut through all three rods. The blade emitted a single pure note that slowly faded into silence. When Aragorn examined the edge where it had struck the iron, he saw that the impact had not damaged it in the slightest.
"Are you well pleased, Dragon Rider?" Runan asked.
"More than pleased, Runan Elder," said Aragorn, and bowed to her. I do not know how I can thank you for such a gift.
You may thank me by killing Galbatorix. If there is any sword destined to slay that mad king, it is this one.
I shall try my hardest, Runan Elder. The elf woman nodded, appearing satisfied.
Well, you finally have a sword of your own, which is as it ought to be. Now you are truly a dragon rider.
Yes, said Aragorn, and held the sword up toward the sky, admiring it. Now I am truly a rider.
Before you leave, one last thing remains for you to do, said Runan.
Oh? She flicked a finger toward the sword.
You must name it, so I can mark the blade and scabbard with the appropriate glyph.
Aragorn walked over to Saphira and said, What do you think?
I am not the one who must carry the blade. Name it as you see fit.
Yes, but you must have some ideas. She lowered her head toward him and sniffed at the sword, then said,
Blue Gem Tooth is what I would name it, or Blue Claw Red.
That would sound ridiculous to humans.
Then what of Reaver, or Gut Ripper, or maybe Battle Claw, or Glitter Thorn, or Limb Hacker? You could name it Terror, or Pain, or Arm Biter, or Eversharp, or Ripple Scale. That on account of the lines in the steel. There is also Tongue of Death and Elf Steel and Star Metal, and many others besides.
Her sudden outpouring surprised Aragorn. You have a talent for this, he said.
Inventing random names is easy. Inventing the right name, however, can try the patience of even an elf.
What of Kingkiller? He asked.
And what if we actually kill Galbatorix? What then? Will you do nothing else of worth with your sword?
Placing the sword alongside Saphira's left foreleg, Aragorn said, It's exactly the same color as you. I could name it after you. A low growl sounded in Saphira's chest.
No.
He fought back a smile. Are you sure? Just imagine if we were in battle and... Her claws sank into the earth.
No, I am not a thing for you to wave about and make fun of.
No, you're right. I'm sorry. Well, what if I named it Hope in the ancient language? Zarok means misery, so wouldn't it be fitting if I were to wield a sword that by its very name would counteract misery?
A noble sentiment,
said Saphira.
But do you really want to give your enemies hope? Do you want to stab Galbatorix with hope?
It's an amusing pun, he said, chuckling.
Once, maybe, but no more.
Stymied, Aragorn grimaced and rubbed his chin, studying the play of light across the glittering blade. As he gazed into the depths of the steel, his eye chanced upon the flame-like pattern that marked the transition between the softer steel of the spine and that of the edges, and he recalled the word Brom had used to light his pipe during the memories Saphira had shared with him. Then Aragorn thought of Yazuak, where he had first used magic, and also of his duel with Durza in Farthen Dur, and in that instant he knew without doubt that he had found the right name for his sword. Aragorn consulted with Saphira, and when she agreed with his choice, he lifted the weapon to shoulder level and said, I am decided.
Sword, I name thee Brisinger.
And with a sound like rushing wind, the blade burst into fire, an envelope of sapphire blue flames writhing about the razor-sharp steel. Uttering a startled cry, Aragorn dropped the sword and jumped back, afraid of being burned. The blade continued to blaze on the ground, the translucent flames charring a nearby clump of grass. It was then that Aragorn realized it was he who was providing the energy to sustain the unnatural fire. He quickly ended the magic, and the fire vanished from the sword. Puzzled by how he could have cast a spell without intending to, he picked up the sword again and tapped the blade with the tip of a finger. It was no hotter than before. A heavy scowl on her brow, Runan stalked forward, seized the sword from Aragorn and examined it from tip to pommel.
"You are fortunate I have already protected it with wards against heat and damage, else you would have just scratched the guard and destroyed the temper of the blade. Do not drop the sword again, Shadeslayer, even if it should turn into a snake, or else I shall take it back and give you a worn-out hammer instead."
Aragorn apologized, and appearing somewhat mollified, Runan handed the sword back to him.
"Did you set fire to it on purpose?" she asked.
"No," said Aragorn, unable to explain what had happened.
"Say it again," ordered Runan.
"What?"
the name, say it again."
Holding the sword as far away from his body as he could, Aragorn exclaimed, "Brisingr!" A column of flickering flames engulfed the blade of the sword, the heat warming Aragorn's face. This time Aragorn noticed the slight drain on his strength from the spell. After a few moments he extinguished the smokeless fire. Once more Aragorn exclaimed, "Brisingr!" And once more the blade shimmered with blue, wraith-like tongues of flame.
"Now there is a fitting sword for a rider and dragon,"
said Saphira in a delighted tone.
"It breathes fire as easily as I do."
"But I wasn't trying to cast a spell," protested Aragorn. "All I did was say Brisingr and..." He yelped and swore as the sword again caught fire, which he put out for the fourth time.
"May I?" asked Runan, extending a hand toward Aragorn.
He gave her the sword, and she too said,
"Brisingr."
A shiver seemed to run down the blade, but other than that it remained inanimate. Her expression contemplative, Runan returned the sword to Aragorn and said,
"I can think of two explanations for this marvel. One is that because you were involved with the forging, you imbued the blade with a portion of your personality, and therefore it has become attuned to your wishes. My other explanation is that you have discovered the true name of your sword. Perhaps both those things are what has happened. In any event, you have chosen well, Shadeslayer. Brisingr. Yes, I like it. It is a good name for a sword."
"A very good name,"
Saphira agreed. Then Runan placed her hand over the middle of Brisingr's blade and murmured an inaudible spell. The elvish glyph for fire appeared upon both sides of the blade. She did the same to the front of the scabbard. Again Aragorn bowed to the elf woman, and both he and Saphira expressed their gratitude to her. A smile appeared on Runan's aged face, and she touched each of them upon their brows with her calloused thumb.
"I am glad I was able to help the riders this once more. Go, Shadeslayer. Go, Brightscales. Return to the Varden. And may your enemies flee with fear when they see the sword you now wield."
So Aragorn and Saphira bid her farewell, and together they departed Runan's house, Aragorn cradling Brisingr in his arms as he would a newborn child. Greaves and Bracers. A single candle lit the inside of the grey wool tent, a poor substitute for the radiance of the sun. Roran stood with his arms outstretched, while Katrina laced up the sides of the padded jerkin she had fitted for him. When she finished, she tugged on the hem of the jerkin, smoothing out the wrinkles, and said, "There now. Is it too tight?" He shook his head. "No." She retrieved his greaves from the cot they shared and knelt before him in the flickering candlelight. Roran watched as she buckled the greaves onto his lower legs. She cupped the curve of his calf with her hand as she secured the second piece of armor, her flesh warm against his through the fabric of his trousers. Standing, she turned to the cot again and picked up his braces. Roran held out his arms toward her and stared into her eyes, even as she stared into his. With slow, deliberate motions, she fastened the braces onto his forearms, then drew her hands from the inside of his elbow down to his wrists, where he clasped her hands with his own. She smiled and pulled free of his gentle grip. Next, from the cot, she took his shirt of mail. She rose up onto the tips of her toes and lifted the hauberk over his head and held it there while he fit his arms into the sleeves. The mail tinkled like ice as she released it and it fell onto his shoulders, unfurling so that the lower edge hung level with his knees. On his head she set his leather arming cap, tying it firmly in place with a knot under his chin. She held his face between her hands for a moment, then kissed him once upon the lips, and fetched his peaked helm, which she carefully slid over the arming cap. Roran slipped his arm around her thickening waist as she started back toward the cot, stopping her.
"Listen to me," he said. "I'll be fine."
He tried to convey all his love for her through the tone of his voice and the strength of his gaze.
"Don't just sit here all alone. Promise me that. Go to Elaine. She could use your help. She's sick and her child is overdue."
Katrina lifted her chin, her eyes gleaming with tears he knew she would not shed until after he had left.
"Must you march in the front line?" she whispered. "Someone must, and it might as well be me. Whom would you send in my stead?" "Anyone. Anyone at all."
Katrina looked down and was silent for a span. Then she removed a red kerchief from the bodice of her dress and said,
"Here, carry this favor of mine, so that the whole world may know how proud I am of you."
And she tied the kerchief to his sword belt. Roran kissed her twice and released her, and she fetched his shield and spear from the cot. He kissed her a third time as he took them from her, then fit his arm through the strap on his shield.
"If something does happen to me," he began to say.
Katrina placed a finger upon his lips.
"Shh! Speak not of it, lest it should come true."
"Very well." He hugged her one last time.
"Be safe. And you."
Although he hated to leave her, Roran raised his shield and strode out of the tent into the pale light of dawn. Men, dwarves, and Urgals streamed westward through the camp, heading toward the trampled field where the Varden were assembling. Roran filled his lungs with the cool morning air, and then followed, knowing that his band of warriors would be waiting for him. Once he arrived at the field, he sought out Jormunda's division, and after reporting to Jormunda, made his way to the front of the group, where he chose to stand next to Yarbog. The Urgal glanced at him, then grunted,
"A good day for a battle."
"A good day."
A horn sounded at the forefront of the Varden as soon as the sun broke over the horizon. Roran hefted his spear and began to run forward like everyone else around him, howling at the top of his lungs as arrows rained down upon them and boulders whistled past overhead, flying in either direction. Ahead of him, a stone wall 80 feet tall loomed. The siege of Feinster had begun. Leave-taking. From Runan's house, Saphira and Aragorn flew back to their treehouse. Aragorn gathered up his belongings from the bedroom, saddled Saphira, and then returned to his usual place upon the crest of her shoulders.
"Before we go to the crags of Telnir," he said, "there is one more thing I must do in Ellesmere."
"Must you?"
she asked. "I won't be content unless I do."
Saphira leaped out from the treehouse. She glided westward until the number of buildings began to diminish, and then she angled downward for a soft landing upon a narrow, moss-covered path. After asking for and getting directions from an elf who was sitting in the branches of a nearby tree, Aragorn and Saphira continued through the woods, until they arrived at a small one-room house, grown out of the bole of a fir tree that stood at an acute angle, as if a constant wind pressed against it. To the left of the house was a soft bank of earth, taller by several feet than Aragorn. A rivulet of water tumbled over the edge of the bank and poured itself into a limpid pool before meandering off into the dim recesses of the forest. White orchids lined the pool. A bulbous root protruded out of the ground from among the slender flowers that grew along the near shore, and sitting cross-legged upon the root was Sloane. Aragorn held his breath, not wanting to alert the other man to his presence. The butcher wore robes of brown and orange, after the fashion of the elves. A thin black strip of cloth was tied around his head, concealing the gaping holes where his eyes had been. In his lap he held a length of seasoned wood, which he was whittling with a small curved knife. His face was covered with far more lines than Aragorn remembered, and upon his hands and arms were several new scars, livid against the surrounding skin.
"Wait here,"
Aragorn said to Saphira, and slipped off her back. As Aragorn approached him, Sloane paused in his carving and cocked his head.
"Go away," he rasped.
Not knowing how to respond, Aragorn stopped where he was and remained silent. The muscles in his jaw rippling, Sloane removed another few curls from the wood he held, then tapped the tip of his knife against the root and said,
"Blast you! Can you not leave me alone with my misery for a few hours? I don't want to listen to any bard or minstrel of yours, and no matter how many times you ask me, I won't change my mind. Now go on, away with you."
Pity and anger welled up inside Aragorn, and also a sense of displacement at seeing a man he had grown up around and had so often feared and disliked brought to such a state. "Are you comfortable?" Aragorn asked in the ancient language, adopting a light, lilting tone. Sloane uttered a growl of disgust.
"You know I cannot understand your tongue, and I do not wish to learn it. The words ring in my ears longer than they ought to. If you will not speak in the language of my race, then do not speak to me at all."
Despite Sloane's entreaty, Aragorn did not repeat the question in their common language, nor did he depart. With a curse, Sloane resumed his whittling. After every other stroke, he ran his right thumb over the surface of the wood, checking the progress of whatever he was carving. Several minutes passed, and then in a softer voice, Sloane said,
"You were right. Having something to do with my hands calms my thoughts. Sometimes I can almost forget what I have lost. But the memories always return, and I feel as if I'm choking on them. I'm glad you sharpened the knife. A man's knives should always be sharp."
Aragorn watched him for a minute more. Then he turned away and walked back to where Saphira was waiting. As he pulled himself into the saddle, he said,
"Sloane does not seem to have changed very much."
And Saphira replied,
"You cannot expect him to become someone else entirely in such a short time."
"No, but I had hoped he would learn something of wisdom here in Ellesmere, and that maybe he would repent of his crimes."
"If he does not wish to acknowledge his mistakes, Aragorn, nothing can force him to. In any event, you have done all you can for him. Now he must find a way to reconcile himself with his lot. If he cannot, then let him seek the solace of the everlasting grave."
From a clearing close to Sloane's house, Saphira launched herself up and over the surrounding trees and headed north toward the crags of Telnair, flapping as hard and fast as she could. The morning sun sat full upon the horizon, and the rays of light that streamed out over the treetops created long, dark shadows that, as one, pointed to the west like purple pennants. Saphira descended toward the clearing by Oromis's pinewood house, where Gleyda and Oromis stood waiting for them. Aragorn was startled to see that Gleyda was wearing a saddle nestled between two of the towering spikes on his back, and that Oromis was garbed in heavy travelling robes of blue and green, over which he wore a corselet of golden scale armour, as well as braces upon his arms. A tall, diamond-shaped shield was slung across his back, an archaic helm rested in the crook of his left arm, and around his waist was belted his bronze-coloured sword, Nagling. With a gust of wind from her wings, Saphira alighted upon the sward of grass and clover. She flicked out her tongue, tasting the air as Aragorn slid to the ground.
"Are you going to fly with us to the Varden?"
she asked, the tip of her tail twitched with excitement.
"We shall fly with you as far as the edge of Duwelden Varden. But there our paths must part," said Oromis.
Disappointed, Aragorn asked, "Will you return to Ellesmere, then?"
Oromis shook his head. "No, Aragorn.
Then we shall continue onward to the city of Gilead. Sapphira hissed with surprise, a sentiment Eragon shared. Why to Gilead? He asked, bewildered.
Because Islan Zadi and her army have marched there from Siunon, and they are about to lay siege to the city, said Gleda.
The strange, gleaming structures of his mind brushed against Eragon's consciousness.
But do not you and Oromis wish to keep your existence hidden from the Empire?
Sapphira asked. Oromis closed his eyes for a moment, his expression withdrawn and enigmatic. The time for hiding has passed, Sapphira. Gleda and I have taught the two of you everything we could in the brief while you were able to study under us. It was a paltry education compared with that you would have received of old. But given how events press on us, we are fortunate to have been able to teach you as much as we did. Gleda and I are satisfied that you now know everything that might help you to defeat Galbatorix. Therefore, since it seems unlikely that either of you will have a chance to return here for further instruction before the conclusion of this war, and since it seems even more unlikely that there shall ever be another dragon and rider for us to instruct, while Galbatorix still bestrides the warm earth, we have decided that we no longer have any reason to remain sequestered in Duweldenvarden. It is more important that we help Islan Zadi and the Varden overthrow Galbatorix than we tarry here in idle comfort while we wait for another rider and dragon to seek us out. When Galbatorix learns that we are still alive, it shall undermine his confidence, for he shall not know if other dragons and riders have survived his attempt to exterminate them. Also, knowledge of our existence shall bolster the spirits of the dwarves and the Varden, and counteract any adverse effects Murtagh and Thorn's appearance on the Burning Plains may have had upon the resolution of their warriors. And it may well increase the number of recruits Nasawada receives from the Empire. Eragon glanced at Nagling and said,
Surely, though, Master, you do not intend to venture into battle yourselves.
And why should we not?
Inquired Oromis, tilting his head to one side.
Since he did not want to offend Oromis or Gleda, Eragon was uncertain how to respond. At last he said, Forgive me, Master. How can you fight when you cannot cast spells that require more than a small amount of energy? And what of the spasms you sometimes suffer? If one were to strike in the middle of a battle, it could prove fatal.
Oromis replied, As you ought to know well by now, mere strength rarely decides the victor when two magicians duel. Even so, I have all the strength I need here in the jewel of my sword.
And he reached across his body and placed the palm of his right hand on the yellow diamond that formed the pommel of Nagling. For over 100 years, Gleda and I have stored every iota of our excess strength in this diamond, and others have added their strength to the pool as well. Twice a week, several elves from Ellesmira visit me here, and transfer as much of their life force into the gem as they can without killing themselves. The amount of energy contained within this stone is formidable, Eragon. With it, I could shift an entire mountain. It is a small matter, then, to defend Gleda and myself from swords and spears and arrows, or even from a boulder cast by a siege engine. As for my sieges, I have attached certain wards to the stone in Nagling that will protect me from harm if I become incapacitated upon the battlefield. So you see, Eragon, Gleda and I are far from helpless.
Chastened, Eragon dipped his head and murmured, Yes, Master.
Oromis's expression softened somewhat.
I appreciate your concern, Eragon.
And you are right to be concerned, for war is a perilous endeavor, and even the most accomplished warrior may find death waiting for him amid the heated frenzy of battle. However, our cause is a worthy one. If Gleda and I go to our deaths, then we go willingly, for by our sacrifice we may help to free Alagazia from the shadow of Galbatorix's tyranny.
But if you die,
said Aragorn, feeling very small. And yet we still succeed in killing Galbatorix and freeing the last dragon egg. Who will train that dragon and his rider? Oromis surprised Aragorn by reaching out and clasping him by the shoulder.
If that should come to pass, said the elf, his face grave, then it shall be your responsibility, Aragorn, and yours, Saphira, to instruct the new dragon and rider in the ways of our order.
Ah, do not look so apprehensive, Aragorn. You would not be alone in the task. No doubt Islanzadi and Nasawada would ensure that the wisest scholars of both our races would be there to help you. A strange sense of unease troubled Aragorn. He had often longed to be treated as more of an adult, but nevertheless he did not feel ready to take Oromis's place. It seemed wrong to even contemplate the notion. For the first time Aragorn understood that he would eventually become part of the older generation, and that when he did, he would have no mentor to rely upon for guidance. His throat tightened. Releasing Aragorn's shoulder, Oromis gestured at Brisingr, which lay in Aragorn's arms, and said, "The entire forest shuddered when you woke the Manoa tree, Saphira, and half the elves in Ellesmere contacted Gleyder and me with frantic pleas for us to rush to her aid. Moreover, we had to intervene on your behalf with Gilderain the Wise, so as to prevent him from punishing you for employing such violent methods."
"I shall not apologize," said Saphira. "We had not the time to wait for gentle persuasion to work."
Oromis nodded. "I understand, and I am not criticizing you, Saphira. I only wanted you to be aware of the consequences of your actions." At his request, Aragorn handed his newly forged sword to Oromis, and held his helm for him while the elf examined the sword.
"Runon has outdone herself," Oromis declared. "Few weapons, swords or otherwise, are the equal of this. You are fortunate to wield such an impressive blade, Aragorn."
One of Oromis's sharp eyebrows rose a fraction of an inch as he read the glyph on the blade.
"Brisingr, a most apt name for the sword of a dragon rider." "Aye," said Aragorn, "but for some reason, every time I utter its name, the blade bursts into..."
He hesitated, and instead of saying fire, which of course was Brisingr in the ancient language, he said,
"Flames."
Oromis's eyebrow climbed even higher.
"Indeed. Did Runan have an explanation for this unique phenomenon?"
As he spoke, Oromis returned Brisingr to Aragorn in exchange for his helm.
"Yes, master," said Aragorn,
and he recounted Runan's two theories. When he had finished, Oromis murmured, "I wonder..." And his gaze drifted past Aragorn toward the horizon. Then Oromis gave a brief shake of his head, and again focused his grey eyes upon Aragorn and Saphira. His face became even more solemn than before.
"I am afraid I have let my pride speak for me. Gleyder and I may not be helpless, but neither, as you pointed out, Aragorn, are we entirely whole. Gleyder has his wound, and I have my own... impairments. It is not for nothing I am called the cripple who is whole. Our disabilities would not be a problem if our only enemies were mortal men. Even in our current state we could easily slay 100 ordinary humans, 100 or 1,000, it would matter little which. However, our enemy is the most dangerous foe we or this land has ever faced. As much as I dislike acknowledging it, Gleyder and I are at a disadvantage, and it is quite possible that we shall not survive the battles yet to come. We have lived long and full lives, and the sorrows of centuries press upon us. But the two of you are young and fresh and full of hope, and I believe your prospects of defeating Galbatorix are greater than those of anyone else."
Oromis glanced at Gleyder, and the elf's face became troubled.
"Therefore, in order to help ensure your survival, and as a precaution against our possible demise, Gleyder has, with my blessing, decided to..."
"I have decided
said Glader.
To give you my heart of hearts, Saphira Brightscales, Aragorn Shadeslayer.
Saphira's astonishment was no less than Aragorn's. Together they stared at the majestic gold dragon who towered high above them. Saphira said,
Master, you honour us beyond words, but are you sure that you wish to entrust your heart to us? I am sure, said Glader,
and lowered his massive head until it was only slightly above Aragorn.
For many reasons, I am sure. If you hold my heart, you shall be able to communicate with Oromis and me, no matter how far apart we may be. And I shall be able to aid you with my strength whenever you are in difficulty. And if Oromis and I should fall in battle, our knowledge and experience, and also my strength, shall still be at your disposal. Long have I pondered this choice, and I am confident it is the right one.
But if Oromis were to die, said Aragorn in a soft voice, would you really want to live on without him? And as an Eldunari? Glader turned his head and focused one of his immense eyes upon Aragorn.
I do not wish to be parted from Oromis, but whatever happens, I shall continue to do what I can to topple Galbatorix from his throne. That is our only goal, and not even death shall deter us from pursuing it. The idea of losing Saphira horrifies you, Aragorn, and rightly so. However, Oromis and I have had centuries to reconcile ourselves with the fact that such a parting is inevitable. No matter how careful we are, if we live long enough, eventually one of us will die. It is not a happy thought, but it is the truth. Such is the way of the world.
Shifting his stance, Oromis said, I cannot pretend that I regard this with favor. But the purpose of life is not to do what we want, but what needs to be done. This is what fate demands of us.
So now I ask you, said Glader, Saphira Brightscales and Aragorn Shadeslayer, will you accept my gift and all that it entails? I will,
said Saphira. I will, replied Aragorn, after a brief hesitation. Then Glader drew back his head. The muscles of his abdomen rippled and clenched several times, and his throat began to convulse, as if something was stuck in it. Widening his stance, the gold dragon extended his neck straight out in front of him, every cord and sinew of his body standing in high relief underneath the armor of his sparkling scales. Glader's throat continued to flex and relax with increasing speed until at last he lowered his head so that it was level with Aragorn and opened his jaws, hot, pungent air pouring from his massive maw. Aragorn squinted and tried not to gag. As he gazed into the depths of Glader's mouth, Aragorn saw the dragon's throat contract one last time, and then a hint of gold light appeared between the folds of dripping blood-red tissue. A second later, a round object about a foot in diameter slid down Glader's crimson tongue and out of his mouth so fast Aragorn nearly missed catching it. As his hands closed around the slippery, saliva-covered Eldunari, Aragorn gasped and staggered backward, for he suddenly felt Glader's every thought and emotion and all of the sensations of his body. The amount of information was overwhelming, as was the closeness of their contact. Aragorn had expected as much, but it still shocked him to realize he was holding Glader's entire being between his hands. Glader flinched, shaking his head as if he had been stung, and quickly shielded his mind from Aragorn, although Aragorn could still sense the flicker of his shifting thoughts, as well as the general color of his emotions. The Eldunari itself was like a giant gold jewel. Its surface was warm and covered with hundreds of sharp facets, which varied somewhat in size and sometimes projected at odd, slanting angles. The center of the Eldunari glowed with a dull radiance, similar to that of a shuttered lantern, and the diffuse light throbbed with a slow, steady beat. Upon first inspection, the light appeared uniform, but the longer Aragorn gazed at it, the more details he saw within it, small eddies and currents that coiled and twisted in seemingly random directions, darker motes that barely moved at all, and flurries of bright flashes no larger than the head of a pin that would flare for a moment, then fade back into the underlying field of light. It was alive.
"Here," said Oromis, and handed Aragorn a sturdy cloth sack.
To Aragorn's relief, his connection with Gleda vanished as soon as he placed the Eldunari in the bag, and his hands were no longer touching the gem-like stone. Still somewhat shaken, Aragorn clasped the cloth-covered Eldunari against his chest, awed by the knowledge that his arms were wrapped around Gleda's essence, and afraid of what might happen to it if he allowed the Heart of Hearts out of his grasp. "Thank you, Master," Aragorn managed to say, bowing his head toward Gleda.
"We shall guard your heart with our lives," Saphira added.
"No!" exclaimed Oromis, his voice fierce. "Not with your lives. That is the very thing we wish to avoid. Do not allow any misfortune to befall Gleda's heart because of carelessness on your part. But neither should you sacrifice yourself to protect him or me or anyone else. You have to stay alive at all costs, else our hopes shall be dashed, and all will be darkness."
Yes, Master,
Aragorn and Saphira said at the same time, he with his tongue, and she with her thoughts. Said Gleda,
"Because you swore fealty to Nessa Wadda, and you owe her your loyalty and obedience. You may tell her of my heart if you must, but only if you must. For the sake of dragons everywhere, what few of us remain, the truth about the Eldunari cannot become common knowledge." "May we tell Arya?"
asked Saphira. "And what about Blodgarm and the other elves Islanzadi sent to protect me?" asked Aragorn. "I allowed them into my mind when Saphira and I last fought Murtagh. They will notice your presence, Gleda, if you help us in the midst of a battle."
"You may inform Blodgarm and his spellcasters of the Eldunari," said Gleda, "but only after they have sworn oaths of secrecy to you."
Oromis placed his helm on his head. "Arya is Islanzadi's daughter, and so I suppose it is proper she should know. However, as with Nessa Wadda, do not tell her unless it becomes absolutely necessary. The secret shared is no secret at all. If you can be so disciplined, do not even think of it, nor of the very fact of the Eldunari, so that no one may steal the information from your minds."
"Yes, Master."
"Now let us be gone from here," said Oromis, and drew a pair of thick gauntlets over his hands. "I have heard from Islanzadi that Nessa Wadda has laid siege to the city of Feinster, and the Varden have great need of you."
"We have spent too long in Ellesmere,"
said Saphira.
"Perhaps,"
said Gleda,
"but it was time well spent."
Taking a short running start, Oromis bounded up Gleda's single foreleg and onto his high, jagged back, where Oromis settled into his saddle and began to tighten the straps around his legs.
"As we fly," said the elf, calling down to Aragorn, "we can review the lists of true names you learned during your last visit."
Aragorn went to Saphira and carefully climbed onto her back, wrapped one of his blankets around Gleda's heart, and packed the bundle in his saddlebags. Then he secured his legs in the same manner as had Oromis. Behind him he could feel a constant thrum of energy radiating from the Eldunari. Gleda walked to the edge of the crags of Telnir and unfurled his voluminous wings. The earth shook as the gold dragon leaped toward the cloud-streaked sky, and the air boomed and shuddered as Gleda drove his wings downward, pulling away from the ocean of trees below. Aragorn gripped the spike in front of him as Saphira followed, flinging herself out into open space and falling several hundred feet in a steep dive before she ascended to Gleda's side. Glader assumed the lead as the two dragons oriented themselves toward the southwest. Each of them flapping at a different tempo, Sephira and Glader sped over the rolling forest.